As the White House threatens to take over state elections, restrict abortion nationwide, and take away our health care, the Wisconsin Supreme Court is the last line of defense for our rights. That's why the Supreme Court election on April 7th is so critical. The ACLU does not endorse or oppose candidates, but wants you to make an informed decision. When it comes to abortion rights, Maria Lazar supported overturning Roe v. Wade and is endorsed by groups that want to ban abortion. Chris Taylor voted against abortion bans and defended abortion rights while working with Planned Parenthood. And on the issue of voting rights in Wisconsin, Maria Lazar defended efforts to rig elections for one political party through extreme gerrymandering of congressional and legislative districts. Chris Taylor opposes rigging the system with extreme partisan gerrymandering. On April 7th, stand up for our rights. Paid for by American Civil Liberties Union, Incorporated.
Talk to me, sister, so you can see.
Welcome back to What's Going On with Earl Ingram. I'd also like to welcome back my good friend and co-host, Mr. Sandy Williams, who, you know, we can talk a lot about all the great things that Sandy has accomplished, but we'll briefly talk about the fact that he's an attorney, he's an economist, he graduated from Harvard cum laude in 1966, he's an economist in economics, and all the other things that my good friend Sandy Williams does. But more than anything else, he's a good friend. And, you know, when I watch the news and see the things that are going on nationally and internationally, you know, and I watch a lot of the national and international shows, but I can't wait to have the conversation with Sandy about those things and what's going on in our nation and globally. And with that backdrop, I'd like to say welcome back, my friend.
Well, it's good to be back. Good to be back. Yeah, 1966. Holy cow.
1966. Yeah. But anyway, Sandy. Yeah. Hey, Sandy, you're still here.
Yeah. I know. You know, absolutely.
And
it's still, my biggest achievement.
Yeah, it's still kicking.
Waking up.
But you know, I wanted to have a conversation with you today. Sandy, I went into the service station get filled up, and I did notice the impact of having to fill my tank, you know, and it was really kind of awakening because of what it's been over the last 2 years. There's a major difference that I noticed in filling it up. Let's talk about the impact that this war is having, Sandy, nationally, internationally, and what your thoughts are?
Well, in terms of economics, you're talking about impacts. And
yes, sir.
You know, this war comes on top of the prior year with the imposition of what are essentially massive tariffs. I mean, they aren't massive in terms of the absolute scale, but they're massive compared to the tariffs that existed prior to this past 12 months. And the balkanization, the breakup of the international order in terms of economics has been very substantial. So we have an administration which has behaved more or less like a bull in a china shop with respect to economic policy. And it seemed to be getting sort of a pass with respect to the extent of the dire consequence of the tariffs. You know, we experienced a modest increase in inflation, but very modest. And the economists who have been observing it have been trying to figure out whether that was just because the reaction to the tariffs is going to be delayed and that there will, in fact, be a significant inflationary influence, or whether the shrinking of the economy at large had enough of a breaking effect so that the increase in importation costs was not necessarily going to be experienced so much by the consumer. Well, that all sort of broke down with the initiation of the Iranian war and the complete, in fact, they think the administration's, that the president would use the word obliteration. He's essentially obliterated the oil, the framework for the oil economy in the world, by causing the Straits of Hormuz to be shut down and by causing the massive oil production in the Mideast to be put into jeopardy by, for instance, the assault on the gas fields and the assaults on the various oil infrastructures. So the table is now set for inflation. The flip side of that is that the numbers we're seeing for jobs in the United States suggest that the table is also set for something that could feel like a recession. And the combination of recession and inflation is something that's been rarely experienced, but because of my graduated from college, I can say both you and I lived through a period in the mid-70s and early 80s, which was called stagflation. Stagflation was a recession coupled with inflation, which had a particularly cruel consequence for those who were hanging on to jobs or losing their jobs in the recession, while at the same time they faced substantially rising prices. And just to finish the thought, here we have in the United States a set of circumstances in which, number one, wars tend to create shortages, and of course the immediate shortage is in oil, but there will be shortages in other goods as the war machine consumes vast portions of what would otherwise be consumed by consumers in the economy, like chips, for instance, electronics. And two, we have an ongoing shortage of housing. And even without the war, which has essentially little effect on housing, we were already experiencing the effects of a shortage on housing by soaring housing costs. And three, with respect to electricity, we have the probability of kind of soaring electric costs to some extent created by the AI, this artificial intelligence revolution, and the need to drive millions of megawatts of demand for electricity that are caused by data centers.
So Sandy, you are painting a pretty bleak picture when you kind of look at the fact that zero job growth, all this inflation, the fact that we're now $39 trillion in debt, that continues to grow. Globally, the impact of what's happening with the price of oil. This is not something that's going to go away overnight. It's only going to ratchet up in the pain and misery that people are going to be feeling. Is it safe to say that?
Well, it is. In particular, you mentioned the national debt. We're currently experiencing deficits at a rate that we've never experienced before. This is the most rapid increase in deficit expenditures since, well, we experienced it during the pandemic briefly when we began to try and stoke an economy which was threatening to die on the vine because of the pandemic. We also had fairly massive deficit expenditures in 2008, trying to climb out of what was almost a depression, not just a deep recession. But now we're experiencing an economy which is relatively sound. The administration would claim it was the strongest economy ever. And yet we're experiencing deficits at a nearly record-breaking rate. And of course, the war is only increasing it. They're talking about now seeking additional funding of $200 to $250 billion for the Defense Department as the result of the effects of and the implications of the war in the Mideast. But that's all going to be additional deficit unless something is done to shore up the balance of incoming and outflowing revenues at the federal governmental level. And we seem to be ducking again, kicking the can down the road with respect to all of the tough decisions that might need to be made. Here we had tax reductions just months ago.
Sandy, what can possibly be done to offset or avert what appears to be just a calamity that we're faced with?
Well, you know, calamity, our economy is very big. The world economy tends to step in and adjust even for our errors. So even right now, we had a weakening dollar, which to some extent was viewed as a goal by this administration to try and make imported goods more expensive and exported goods less expensive. A weak dollar has essentially the same effect as tariffs, doing those things. So our dollar was getting weaker, whether that was good or not in the long run. That was what was happening. Now, suddenly, during this war, the dollar has soared in value because regardless of what we might be thinking about the U.S. economy, it is the safest economy in the world. We are going to have the least impact from the price on oil, much less than Japan, much less than Europe, and much less than China, all of whom are heavily dependent on imported oil. We are not heavily dependent on imported oil. Our price of oil is affected by the world market, but the quantity of oil available to U.S. citizens is quite adequate, so that our economy is likely to suffer less in an oil short world than the rest of the economies. And unless the whole world economy goes into the ditch, the American economy tends to be stronger. So, you know, we have the rest of the world trying to buoy us up and keep us from stepping in the stuff that we are actually trying, apparently, to step in with our kind of lack of discipline in the fiscal area policies.
So, Sandy, our exporting of goods to the world is it, I don't know where we are with that. I mean, don't we still export quite a bit of things to the rest of the world?
No, I mean, not net-wise. You know, we still have a net substantial trade deficit. In fact, one of the interesting results of all these tariffs was that our trade deficit actually didn't decline last year, might be declining somewhat this year, but we're not talking about going to zero. We're just talking about a very, very big trade deficit in the neighborhood of $1 trillion, moving downward to hundreds of billions of dollars, many hundreds of billions of dollars, but less than a trillion. So, no, we are, particularly on the manufacturing side, we import more than we export. On the service side, we export more than we import. That's the only area where we have a surplus. But with respect to oil, we have at least an oil supply that's within our geographic area that is able to supply our economy. And that's really why the rest of the economies look at us as being somewhat stronger in the current circumstance.
So, Sandy, you're an economist, and I'm just a guy who remembers in those, you know, 60s, 70s, and when, you know, low job growth, high interest rates, inflation, all meant recession. And what's different today?
Well, you know, we do have differences, but I'm afraid that the sun, the moon, and the stars can line up for stagflation in more than one fashion. What you need in stagflation is you need shortages that cause the price of those things to continue to get bid up, while at the same time, you have a soft job market where jobs are not increasing. In fact, in recessions, jobs are decreasing. Well, what do we have today? We have a shrinking job market, you know, with the adjustments that have been made over the data that was provided us for the last 6 months suggests that for the last 6 months, our job creation has been dwindling to the point of being negative currently. And so, you know, okay, so we have a very soft job market and we have inflation. We have some embedded shortages like housing. It's going to be very difficult to solve a housing shortage problem in a near term. And so we have housing costs that are going up dramatically. We have healthcare costs that are being driven up dramatically by pressures that are in excess of inflation, but are highly inflationary. And that has to do with the design of our healthcare system and the built-in incentives. So we have healthcare, a major expense, increasing rapidly. Housing, a major expense, increasing rapidly. Electricity in shortage, which is likely to cause increases in the cost of electricity as we build more power plants to try and meet demands. And then we have oil, and the price of oil internationally, without governmentally imposed price fixing, the price of oil is going to follow the international price here in the United States, whether or not we have enough. Those who export oil from the United States will set the price.
You know, Sandy, there was a number that was set that said if the barrel of oil reached $137 a barrel, that the United States would then start to feel and be in danger of heading towards recession. We're vastly moving towards that number quickly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're sort of catapulting toward that number, particularly as the threats in the Mideast war seem to be focused on whether or not we are going to destroy the capacity to produce and ship oil in the Mideast, whether we are, whether Iran is. And ultimately, it's the gun that Iran has to the West's throat, which is their control of the Hormuz Strait, which implies their control over the flow of 25% of the world's oil and gas. And so it's definitely at risk, and being at risk will cause its price to go up as the marketplace starts to price risk into the current price of oil. And that's what they've started to do. So, you know, and the fact is that we could have a recession without the trigger of oil price in our economy. I mean, everyone has had a view that the economy is in some respects fragile, and that fragility was tested and has been tested by the tariffs, by the sort of dramatic and volatile changes in policy in Washington. And now we have a volatile change in the world order generally, which is relating now to oil, but we have a change in the world order, which is dramatic. And that in and of itself, in the long run, will create instability.
So, Sandy, if we're talking again, we've seen ebbs and flows of prices of oil over decades, and those things generally, you know, wind their way through and then they come back and they level off. But we're talking about the destruction of facilities that produce this that won't be coming back immediately, Sandy. We're talking long-term, right?
Yeah, well, and we're also talking exposing those who import oil, exposing them to the reality of the risk of being an oil importer. Because if you're an oil importer, you are a potential victim of external circumstances, whether they're imposed upon you by the producer of the oil or whether they're imposed upon you by someone who intervenes, much the way the United States has intervened in the Mideast in the bombing and the war on Iran. So I think you typically what's happened in the past when we have these kind of wake-up calls about oil is that the rest of the world decides they want to become much less dependent on oil. Well, how do we do that? Well, renewable resources for producing electricity, electric vehicles to get gasoline out of the highway mode of transportation. And we can expect to see nations again moving significantly in that direction, much as the current administration would like to be eliminating windmills and causing V8 engines to become the state of the art with respect to automobile transportation. It runs contrary to the notion that nations will want to minimize the risk in their economy. And one of the major risks for Europe, one of the major risks for Japan, and a major risk for China is the fact that they need to import their oil. Now, in the short term, they can accommodate themselves by importing from Russia. India can import from Russia. And so this has played into the hands of Russia in terms of being the significant alternative provider. And Russia's an economy which has been very fragile at $65 a barrel, at $60 a barrel, but is quite robust at $115 a barrel. And that's where we're at.
So, Sandy, is it safe to say that we would be closer if things don't change as it relates to the price of the barrel of oil? Are we closer to global recession than we are to our local recession? And if that's the case, could that then eventually draw us into?
Oh, sure. I mean, the fact is that we are, you know, we are embedded in the world and we are not independent from the world. And as much as the administration might like to say, we don't need any of you. We're the most powerful country in the world. It's not true economically. Now, it has always been true that when the United States sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. But when the rest of the world catches a cold, the United States starts sneezing. It might be not quite as direct an impact, but there's no question that a recession in the world will be a contagion that we will catch. It will affect many parts of our economy, including the financial side of our economy, which is actually kind of a major heartthrob of the flywheel of our economy, is our capacity to be the financial center of the world. Well, if the world's finances begin to crumble, being the financial center of a crumbling world financial system is less valuable. Let's put it that way.
So, Sandy, let's say all of those factors that you have just pointed out come to pass. And the fact that we are $39 trillion in debt, that doesn't make it any easier for us to navigate the pain, no. Does it?
No, because if we have a stagflation, stagflation is embedded with inflation and recession. And the last time we were in a stagflation, the only way we got out of it was Paul Volcker courageously and independently raising interest rates to the sky.
Yeah.
And if interest rates go up very much at all, our national debt, the cost of our national debt will blow through the ceiling. Right now, at the current cost of debt, we are expending $1 trillion a year to service our national debt because of the scale of the debt. And the problem with national debt has always been, when economists look at it, that, well, national debt is okay if it's a relatively low percentage of the GDP. But if the servicing of the national debt becomes a significant percentage of our tax revenues, and if our GDP begins to shrink, as it does as the definition of a recession would imply, if our GDP begins to shrink, but our deficit continues to climb at near record levels of a trillion plus a year, we will climb into a completely unexperienced path for the United States, where the national debt as a percentage of our economy becomes unsustainably high, and the rest of the world will begin to recognize it at some point. And our fiat currency, meaning that our dollar, which doesn't have gold behind it, it only has the promise of the United States that the dollar has a dollar of value. Fiat currencies can ultimately become fragile in a circumstance like runaway national debt as a percentage of GDP. So we need to wake up, and we need to sober up. Our Washington operations need to become stabilized. We need to stop destabilizing the world in a manner which puts greater pressure indirectly on us and directly on us, or we're going to have to come to grips with some very serious problems.
You know, Sandy, the pain that you and other economists are pointing to, and clearly you are pointing out to those who run this nation, that this is a serious, serious time, and it's going to take courage and steadfastness on the part of Congress, Sandy.
Yes.
To grow a pair, right?
And yeah, because, I mean,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, Washington needs to, what I would say, get a grip. They just have lost their grip on a disciplined approach to facing the issues that the United States faces, putting those issues into an appropriate triage that doesn't necessarily involve foreign adventures. Somehow, frequently, almost continually, when our national leadership weighs the issues faced by the United States, what climbs to the very top is international issues. And, you know, it took us into Vietnam. It took us into the Mideast. We're back in the Mideast again. And are these issues really the primary issues that the American people need to have addressed? Because they have led directly to massive deficits. They've led directly to channeling massive dollars into military rather than into healthcare or into education or into infrastructure. So we should understand that dollars are finite. And in spite of the lack of discipline in Washington that came to believe that we could print dollars as needed, that printing process has gotten us pretty close to the wall with respect to how much it can continue.
Sandy, I'm as far from an economist as one could possibly be. But what I do know and what I do understand is that our government certainly is going to need, in order to address the issues like health care and all those other things, a coming home philosophy that we're going to have to use finances to address these issues that we don't have now because we've cut the taxes on the wealthiest people in our nation. We can't continue down that path and then increase the military spending and say, well, we don't have any money for the other things. At some point in time, Sandy, we've got to come out of that, and Democrats and Republicans can't be at odds. There's going to have to be a united front to address these issues. Is it safe to say that?
Well, I think so. And I think the campaign rhetoric of the last campaign, America First, sounded like that's what would be paid attention to, that putting America first would maybe cause us to do a triage of America's issues. But we never got into an honest process of doing that. We never rolled up our sleeves and decided that we had to redesign our healthcare approach. We never rolled up our sleeves and figured out how exactly we would attack the housing shortage to try and solve for that. And the list is long in terms of domestic issues that we put our head in the sand about. Now, some of this might be because domestic issues are the realm of Congress, and the realm of international affairs is pretty much held by the office of the president. And so if you simply get into office and want to do things, you can run out of things you can do domestically pretty quickly, but the list is long in terms of what it is you can do in terms of foreign adventures, or at least the attention you can get for having foreign adventures is unlimited. And so that's where we seem to move ever since 1970. I think we can say that basically Washington has shut down with respect to its focus on domestic issues and has basically turned its attention internationally and maybe to the interests of private interests.
You know, Sandy, I'm reading where farmers are concerned they don't have fertilizer for the crops this coming year, and because they need the oil to derivatives from the oil to produce the fertilizer, they can't get access to that. We're coming close to planting season, Sandy. It's you can kind of see this collision course taking shape where even the price of food is going to be astronomical.
Well, food is going to be affected because the movement of food requires shipping. Shipping is fuel intensive. The process of producing food is fuel intensive. And fertilizers are in many ways directly derived from petroleum, and or coming from places where petroleum is also an important product. So, yeah, the disruption, war and disruptions from war, particularly large-scale wars, are ones that are, what we currently have is a war that's very close to the cardiopulmonary system of the world. You know, the cardiopulmonary system involving oil and energy is right there in the Mideast. And so, you know, this is a blow to the chest. And in some respects, I think that's the reckless aspect of it, because the downside of creating a hornet's nest in the Mideast is very big. It's a very, very large and sort of dangerous downside. And I think that's what the rest of the world is trying to price into its current activities.
You know, Sandy, you and I have been around a little while, and we've clearly seen many presidents who were faced with the same situation that this president was faced with as it relates to Iran. They could have done the exact same thing. They listened to people who had a reason, who knew that the involvement in this, to this degree, long-term ramifications of it wouldn't be worth what we're facing right now. And Sandy, we're not even facing what we're going to be facing, right? It's what's coming that we're talking about.
Yeah, the what we have learned in the Mideast is that the fuse is very long. When you light it, you can see immediate effects. There are explosions and what have you, but it's a very long fuse. And the fallout after the fighting and after the apparent fighting has been far more detrimental in the Mideast than the fighting itself. So, you know, we invaded Iraq. And the invasion portion of that was relatively successful. But what we left behind and created was a vacuum, which led directly to the development of ISIS. And ISIS has been a long-term cancer in the Mideast. And I think we can expect the same sort of long fuse coming out of this sort of a thing. Iran is the largest country in the Mideast, 90 million people. Iran is one of the oldest countries ever. You know, it dates back to the Persian Empire. It's a very old culture, and it's not a culture that's likely to bail out on itself very quickly. And we can look at it and say, well, yes, in 1950, it was very secular, and today it's being run by some ideologues that are way outside the realm. But the fact is that those ideologues have developed an institutional system for managing and controlling Iran. And we should understand that when the Shah ran Iran, he did it in the same manner. He had a secret police. He had a vicious kind of an approach to dissent. And so Iran has long been living in the environment that it currently lives in. This happens to be an ideologically Islamic empire, but before that, it was an ideologically right-wing dictatorial empire. And so our ability to decapitate it and expect that it will simply fall into our arms the way Venezuela did. I mean, let's unpack what happened in Venezuela. We decapitated Venezuela, taking out the very top member of a very corrupt regime, but we didn't get rid of the regime. We didn't answer the demands of the people on the street who were saying, we want regime change, we want democracy. We embraced the corrupt regime because we said they're going to do our bidding now. They're going to send petroleum our direction now. They're going to let our companies come in and drill for the oil and to own oil rights there. And so we essentially just compromised the existing regime. That wasn't going to be possible. I think, unfortunately, the administration at the very top believed that they could decapitate Iran and they could find people in Iran who would be just as, I guess, from a standpoint of Iranian interests, as corrupt as the Venezuelan leadership that fell into our arms. And we'd find leadership in Iran that would run to us and do our bidding. Not going to happen. Then I think our president has said, well, I'll deal with people in Iran who are in leadership if they'll simply come to us and do our bidding. But I think we cannot expect that to happen here. So we have a completely different circumstance, but we applied the same strategy.
So we want to take a short break as for you to hear from our great sponsor, the ACLU, and we'll be right back.
As the White House threatens to take over state elections, restrict abortion nationwide, and take away our health care, the Wisconsin Supreme Court is the last line of defense for our rights. That's why the Supreme Court election on April 7th is so critical. The ACLU does not endorse or oppose candidates, but wants you to make an informed decision. When it comes to abortion rights, Maria Lazar supported overturning Roe v. Wade and is endorsed by groups that want to ban abortion. Chris Taylor voted against abortion bans and defended abortion rights while working with Planned Parenthood. And on the issue of voting rights in Wisconsin, Maria Lazar defended efforts to rig elections for one political party through extreme gerrymandering of congressional and legislative districts. Chris Taylor opposes rigging the system with extreme partisan gerrymandering. On April 7th, stand up for our rights. Paid for by American Civil Liberties Union, Incorporated.
Talk to me, sister, so you can see.
All right, welcome back to What's Going On with Earl Ingram, and welcome back, my good friend, Mr. Sandy Williams, again, an attorney, economist, a Harvard grad who graduated cum laude in 1966. And
you can leave that part out.
but what he is clearly is a man who knows his way around what is happening globally and with the economies around the world and especially ours. And, you know, Sandy, we've been talking about all the different things that may unfortunately come to pass soon, not only in our nation, but globally because of the decisions that were made several weeks ago. What about, Sandy, the impact of all the refugees that are going to come out of this, Lebanon, Iran? Where are these people going to go? What is the impact of creating this pool of refugees on all these other nations?
Well, that's what I was talking about, the long fuse. That's part of that long fuse. Every one of the wars that have occurred in the Mideast have resulted in floods of refugees coming out of Syria, coming out of Iraq, coming out of Somalia. When you have a vacuum, and that's unfortunately what we have created in most of the circumstances where we've gone in at the start thinking that we would accomplish regime change, is we've created regime vacuums. And in that vacuum, anarchy develops. And anarchy is unsustainable, and it's particularly cruel to the Tom, Dick, and Marys of each of the countries. And so you end up with massive flights of people. And, you know, Europe has experienced a great influx of migration. The United States has. The rest of the world has. And it's not easy to absorb. It in many respects, has caused a backlash social movement in all of these countries that is potentially dangerous internally to each of the countries in terms of changing the social order within, moving countries away from democracy and towards kind of a hardline right government.
So, Sandy, I'm just from the perspective of a lay person. We haven't learned anything from bombing. Yeah, we've got a lot of bombs, Sandy, that we can drop on people. We can destroy people's countries. We can level those things like what took place in Gaza. But that does, or what we did in Japan, or what we did in Iran, or what we did in Afghanistan. We haven't learned.
Or Vietnam.
Or Vietnam. You know, yeah, Vietnam. We haven't learned anything from that. I watch our defense, Secretary of Defense, come before the world and his eyes light up about all the great bombs that we are dropping on people. How do we even think, Sandy, that if after we've done the damage that we're going to be are doing to Iran, that somehow those people are now going to come to us and say, oh, we are free. We've leveled their nation. How do they reconcile that that's going to come back overnight? The decades that it's going to take to even try to bring that back to a semblance of where it was is going to be painful.
Well, that has been the experience. I mean, we Vietnam has come around to being almost an ally of ours. But the fact is that I think when you have a foreign policy that's based on obliterating the enemy, defining someone to be an enemy and then deciding that the proper course is to obliterate the enemy. Well, first of all, enemies tend to be governments and not people.
Right.
Obliteration tends to be people and not governments. And so I think we turn things on our head when we have policymakers who believe that obliterating an enemy is going to bring them to their knees and bring them to our side. you can potentially bring a government to its knees, but only in the circumstance in which the people who would otherwise support the government have decided not to. And I think we have found that an effort to obliterate can frequently unify people behind a government. You know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and a friend of my enemy is my enemy. And so, you know, if you're a person in Iran and you're upset with your government, but you're in the process of having a culture obliterated, you probably don't jump on your government in that circumstance.
You know, Sandy, let me ask you again, because all these things are going through my head as I'm watching this, and I'm saying, well, what if I'm on the other side of all this bombing? And other nations are watching this, and they're saying, hey, that could happen to us. We've kind of seen what the most powerful nation militarily is doing and has done this. Now we've seen it twice inside of a year, these kind of bombings, other nations. Maybe we want a nuclear weapon because it's our only deterrent. So wouldn't it make sense? I mean, I'm not second guessing our nation. I'm just talking about if I'm on the other side of this, I got to think of something to protect myself. We saw what North Korea did. They created the weapon. It's kind of a standoff once you have the weapon. Is it safe to say that?
Well, absolutely. And that if there's an impetus for Iran to get a nuclear weapon, I believe that is the major impetus. We would like to impute to Iran a desire to get the nuclear weapon so that they can use it on Israel or whatever. But I'm not sure their conduct is consistent with that. I think the conduct of the most nations, Pakistan has a nuclear weapon because India does,
right.
and they have a standoff, but neither one is using it. Israel has a nuclear weapon. They actually stole it from us, but you know, they aren't using it, God willing. And so I think we should understand that the drive to get nuclear weapons, particularly amongst in a world in which there is a nation or several nations that are so much bigger and so much more powerful. And if the world order has become fragile, the world order after World War II was that we would honor the sovereignty of nations large and small. But we seem to be running roughshod over that right now. Our national policy seems to be, we'll take whatever it is we can take, Greenland, Venezuela,
Cuba. Yes.
You know, we're talking like an imperialistic, colonializing power. And in the face of that, the only defense actually any country has directly from military defense is something that is a trump card. And the only trump card militarily is a nuclear weapon. So, yeah, we're probably creating an appetite across the world for people to be able to have a nuclear weapon so that they can have a trump card that they can stand up with. But I think all of this, we started out talking about the world economy. All of this is what's getting priced into the current world economy, because all of these are the kind of geopolitical risks that have the potential to make the future much less profitable, much less predictably profitable for businesses. And that's what ultimately the financial world is looking at. What is the world going to be like? How can we do business, and how profitable will business be 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now? And what we're doing now in the terms of changing the world order is we're making that prognostication, we're making that crystal ball very opaque, very murky. People are having a great deal of trouble predicting how smoothly the world will operate in the future and how it will operate in the future in terms of being sustainable for economic growth.
You know, Sandy, you mentioned that we're starting to, you know, sound like an imperial nation. I think if we look at what we see with our own eyes, we have become that. And I don't know how once you become that in the eyes of the rest of the world, how you can go back and what it's going to take to build trust back in the rest of the world, that it took decades, Sandy. I mean, half a century, almost a century to build and rebuild, right? I mean, that's how far back we've fallen.
Yeah, since World War II, we've actually had a principle that foreign policy was a relatively nonpartisan dynamic, and that regardless of which party was in power, our foreign policies would be quite predictable. And that made for the capacity of other nations to operate with us in a manner of trust, to not worry about what might happen day after tomorrow, to have an understanding that the United States would be there if needed in the context of the, for instance, NATO alliance. And what do we have today? You know, we have complete uncertainty about all of those things. We have complete uncertainty about what it is that the United States and its body politic might elect into office and how that person might behave. You know, in the past, I'm sure the rest of the world thought, well, now we got George Bush, now we have Bill Clinton. It wasn't as big a factor in terms of how it would impact them as today. Now they'll be looking at our elections and saying, well, now we have Donald Trump, and now they're holding their breath, like, who will we have next, and what kind of policies will they impose? And we just haven't had that kind of uncertainty for many decades. And we should understand that creates a whole different environment in terms of people dealing with the United States, people dealing with one another in the world. You know, the old world order, as the premier of Canada has indicated, the old world order is done. It's broken because of the fact that you can't really glue these pieces back together again in a way that everyone will trust its viability.
You know, Sandy, I saw the current president of the United States on a clip this morning. He had, is it a premier of Japan? Is that what is it?
Yeah.
The premier of Japan was in the White House, and she's sitting there. She's a meek-looking woman. And he was putting on his show, right? And he looked in the cameras, and he said something about, we don't want to do something sneaky like you guys did with Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, I know. You made a joke. Well, yeah. It was like, why didn't you tell the Allies about the invasion of Iran? Why didn't you clue them in? He said, well, why didn't Japan tell us about Pearl Harbor? We wanted it to be a surprise.
Did you see the look on her face?
Well,
you know, how uncomfortable she felt. And he didn't think he didn't think there was anything wrong. That's an ally, Sandy.
Well, like I said, the world order, our allies. I mean, who was a stronger ally of ours but Canada? And our relationship with Canada right now is in some state of quasi-divorce. You know, we're at least separated, and we're talking to attorneys about a divorce. And and Mexico's same deal. And of course, Europe, the whole European Union is on edge with us. Our relationship with England, which is supposed to be a totally special relationship, has become one of barbs and attacks. So, like I said, the world order as we know it is broken. And the way it's broken, I'm afraid, suggests that it will be very hard to put back together again. And when it is put back together again, it might not look just right.
So, with the world order being turned inside out and upside down, that means, it really means something globally, right? We may say in our minds, we're still at the top of that world order, but globally, it might mean something else. Is it safe to say that?
Well, I would say this, that we might be at the top, but it used to be at the top without people begrudging it to us.
Right.
If we remain at the top, it will only be with the rest of the world begrudging it, and the rest of the world trying to figure out how to make themselves less reliant on an unreliable partner. And in the long run, that will be damaging to us. Like I said, all of what we do in the world in terms of our world conduct has a much longer fuse than our news, than the news media would want to suggest, than our standard ability to focus our attention span would address. But in fact, foreign policy, not just military foreign policy, but foreign policy at large, has a very long fuse. One of the reasons the State Department was filled with career civil servants is those people understood the fuse. They understood the long term. They were there to try and make sure that the United States kept up a reliable sort of foreign policy, which was good for the United States, but which was good for it in the long term. And we seem to have gotten rid of all of that long-term perspective, both historically and looking to the future. And so I would say that, back to the economic issues again, these are the things that ultimately are very disturbing to the world economy. And so, you know, I remain very concerned.
So, Sunday, one last thing as it relates to the economy. And all I know is we're heading towards a summer of maybe discontent with the American people. Again, I began our conversation with saying I went to the pump yesterday. And, you know, I've been going back and forth, but yesterday I almost saw $4 a gallon regular gas in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Okay, what does that mean in California, Sandy? What does that mean out west? What does that mean in other nations, in other cities? You know, we've been pretty stable with our gas prices. They've been pretty low. What about these other cities, Sandy? If it's $4 a gallon in Milwaukee, what can it possibly be in California? And how long can people withstand that kind of, you know, assault on their livings, their standards of living? All of that is going to continue to tumble down.
Well, you know, I'm not as expert about geopolitical responses to economic circumstances, but I think it doesn't take a wizard to know that when the people face economic hardship, and as we talked about in some prior podcasts, we have an economy that has this K-shaped sort of proprietor interest. The upper part of the K, the top 25% of the people in this economy are on an upward sweeping, confidence building, wealth believing kind of a trajectory. But the bottom 75% are living paycheck to paycheck. And as far as they're concerned, they're on that downward sweeping part of the bottom part of the K. That's the majority of the people in this country. And as that becomes palpably more difficult for them, I think we can expect social political changes to occur.
Sandy, last thing. I heard yesterday that 40% of the American people can't afford their credit card debt, which the interest on the credit cards are rising.
Yeah.
Listen, I mean, that's a recipe, Sandy, for disaster.
Well, that we have a recipe. We do have a recipe for recession that relates to liquidity and lack of liquidity amongst the people. We have car loans that are getting much longer in duration and more onerous in terms of total interest paid. We have used car loans that are larger than ever experienced before. We have consumer debt, which ultimately can be a significant problem if it as an overhang over the economy, as it becomes more difficult for them to pay. And of course, that's an outcome that comes from things that are higher on the totem pole of needs getting more expensive, like fuel, like heat, like housing. Like, you know, all those things are very basic. And so once the basic costs go up in cost and become more of a pinch, the things that are more collateral suffer, and consumer credit is one of the first.
Well, you know, my friend, it's always great having a conversation with you. And, you know, these are hard truths that you have spoken today. And you don't ever, the thing I know about you, Sandy, is you're always an optimist. And, you know, I'm not saying you're not optimistic now, but it kind of a truth serum, right? I mean, we can't stick our heads in the sand.
I'm not very optimistic right now, unless and until Washington gets a grip and starts facing real issues instead of manufactured ones and manufacturing ones, which distract from the real fundamental problems faced by our country.
Well, hearing that from you, my friend, you know, I have to take a deep breath. But we're going to leave it there for now. Thank you, as always, my friend. It's always good talking to you. That's a wrap on What's Going On with Earl Ingram, and thanks to ACLU for the sponsorship. See you next time.
Talk to me, sister, so you can see, sister.